All right, Ms. Squillace, it's up to you.
Let's rock
it. Over to you. Oh, wait.
She's not gonna wait, is the thing.
Do what I say, except right now. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us, in our Tuesday slogan, is as smart as all of us.
That's right. I'm Molly Wood. It is indeed Tuesday. We're calling in some assistance for a deep dive into a single topic. And today, we're taking a little bit of a break from all of the bummer to talk about this fascinating topic, right to repair. The idea, and I know that this may sound amazing, but this is the idea that you should have the legal right to fix your own things that you own.
Craziness.
And I say that because in some ways, you don't. The best known example, of course, is Apple. Like if you need a new battery in your iPhone, for the longest time, you had to go to the Apple store to get it fixed, and then you could go to some authorized retailers, maybe. But they are far from the only company doing this. This affects all kinds of things, from tractors to cars to consumer electronics to coffee makers.
My favorite part of this whole thing is the tractors. So the bottom line is this. Until last week, the right to repair movement, I guess you could call it now, had been mostly a state-level thing. 27 states are thinking about right to repair bills to make it, your right to repair the stuff you own, as Molly was talking about. But President Biden said in an executive order last week that, among 71 other things, told the Federal Trade Commission, actually asked, because he doesn't actually control the FTC, to start drafting rules around right to repair. And the FTC said, okay, fine, Joe, we'll do that for you later this month. In addition to, oh, by the way, taking on big tech, but that's a whole different thing. But that's why we're talking about it.
Yep. And here to make us smart is Kyle Weens, who's the CEO of iFixit, a website where he and his staff teach people how to fix their own technology. They sell the parts and the tools and upload the manuals. Kyle has been an advocate for the right to repair movement for a very long time, before most of us realized it was a thing. He's been on tech several times and is kind of the best guy to give us the lay of the land. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess take us all the way back to the stuff that you've been immersed in for this big chunk of your life. What is the right to repair movement, and how far back does it go?
Well, right to repair is the idea that if you really own it, you ought to be able to fix it. And I mean, right to repair, you know, it's interesting. We have actually laws on the books to protect your right to repair for cars. So if you think about the auto repair market, you can take your car to a local mechanic and they can do any repair. Even on the more modern, sophisticated computers, they can fix those. And that is not by accident. Car repairs or independent mechanics have been protected by a series of laws, actually going all the way back to the 1970s and the original Clean Air Act, when it said that car manufacturers had to make available to local garages information to maintain fancy emission systems like catalytic converters.
So how do we get from catalytic converters to, like, iPhones, right? Because the iPhone thing is, Apple has a closed ecosystem, and you understand why people want in there. But there's a whole chain of events that get us from there to here.
Right, and the very first iPhone was kind of the beginning of the cell phone world being locked down. The iPhone was obviously a revolution. It changed the world. It brought us a fast internet browser in our pocket, very exciting. But it also was the first major phone that had a glued-in battery. And ever since, right, it used to be you could just swap the battery on your phone. Well, the iPhone glued in the battery, and then everyone copied the iPhone. All the phones that are on the market are basically copies of the iPhone. They also copied that glued in battery. And when the iPhone came out, every smartphone manufacturer would sell you a battery. Now only one of them does.
But what else is on the list? I mean, did the iPhone really kick off a new era of you can't repair your stuff? Or was this a trend that was building in other parts of the economy also?
This is a trend that I think is inevitable. We're at kind of a collision point where electronics are making its way into, you know, pretty much everything that we have. We've got the Internet of Things. If you buy a coffee machine, like a Keurig actually has more weight in electronics in it than a laptop.
Wow.
So all kinds of modern devices now have electronics in it, and those electronics do a few things. One, they kind of artificially limit the life of products because electronics just don't last as long. But two, they give manufacturers all kinds of opportunities to monopolize service.
Well, say more about that.
Mm-hmm. So when you control the intellectual property of a product, You can do things like say no one can, you know, make a replacement part. For example, the iPhone, you get an iPhone 12 and the back panel is just a sheet of glass, but it's a sheet of glass with the Apple logo on it. I can't make an aftermarket replacement glass for the back of an iPhone and put the Apple logo on it. They won't give me permission. And Apple won't sell that glass to anyone, period. It's just a sheet of glass. And if you go into the Apple store and you pay them to do that repair, it's $549. Yeah, so that's
Sorry.
Painful. And we see this across the board that you get like the moment you get shoehorned into having to pay the manufacturer repair, it is so expensive that people oftentimes turn to just buy a new one.
So in a way, this is a version of, you know, never take your car to the dealer because it costs more, except never take your car to the dealer isn't an option because only the dealer is allowed to fix it.
Right. The never take your car to the dealer, that's predicated in there is an option. You can take your car to a local mechanic. And I think it's so interesting that we have this world of cars where there's a thriving competitive repair market and the local mechanics are keeping the dealership honest and everyone just kind of has baked in. Of course, I have options. I can get my car fixed where I want. Well, you can't with other things. So I have a friend. Right. I'm here in San Luis Obispo, California, Tally Family Farms down the road. They're a relatively large farm locally and they have two full-time mechanics and they have a big garage bay and they have lifts and all kinds of equipment for working on tractors and trucks. And they tell me if they need to replace the transmission in their F-150 pickup, they can. If they need to do that exact same repair in their John Deere tractors, they can't because John Deere won't give them the software. They can physically install a new transmission, but they can't make it work.
Mm-hmm. And this is why, that's why it's a competition issue. Sorry to jump you.
No.
You're,
you know, you're,
that right
you're
there
exactly
is
right.
why.
Yeah.
Right. Fundamentally, it's about do we want to enable manufacturers to have a monopoly? Like the default is without right to repair protections, every company that makes a thing is going to have a monopoly on service. And we've seen Apple and John Deere have been the most aggressive at protecting and monetizing that monopoly. But it's an option for every product in the market.
How many, not people, but what slice of the market do you suppose actually wants to fix their own stuff? Because I promise you, if I took my iPhone apart, I would wreck it.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't matter if you want to fix your own thing or not. It's about what it does to the market.
Yeah.
So you have the option to go into a local mall and get your phone fixed. That lowers price. But also the fact that competition exists is going to keep the Apple Store honest. It will keep their prices maintained, right? Because they have to compete. When they don't have to compete, prices go up and service goes down for everybody. And I would say even if you don't have a thing that's broken and your thing never breaks, it still benefits you having a thriving repair economy because it increases the value of used products. So when you're done with your phone and you want to be able to sell it, if people do have repair options for that product, there's a much higher resale value. Just think like a Honda Civic is very easy to repair and they have a very high resale value compared to other vehicles that are not as easy to work on.
Right. I was going to say that in a sort of only slightly roundabout way, this also leads to less waste. There is an environmental component to this because you don't have to throw away stuff just because it crapped out.
Absolutely. If every American were to hang on to the phone that they have just a year longer, it would be the greenhouse gas equivalent of taking 600,000 cars off the road.
So I noticed that the president did this thing via executive order. The other option, of course, is legislation, but he didn't do it that way, presumably because it wouldn't have passed, which gets to the question of who is opposed to right to repair.
This is interesting because I've yet to meet a human that was not employed by a manufacturer that opposed this. This is not a partisan issue. We have, there's 27 states that have introduced this legislation. We have legislators in Nebraska leading the charge. They're very conservative. We've got folks in Massachusetts more on the liberal side of the spectrum. This is a bipartisan issue. It's really just large corporations that are protecting a monopoly that are opposed. And they're spending a lot of money to stop it, which is why we haven't gotten it done yet. But it's really nice to see the Biden administration step up on behalf of citizens.
What about their arguments? You know, John Deere and Apple and others say, well, if we release this proprietary repair information, I mean, this is sort of classic Apple, right? If we let you have free reign, you'll just break things and have a worse experience and potentially get a virus, or there will be cybersecurity risks and tractor hacks. What is your response to that? Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think I know.
Well, Apple wants to control the entire experience, and I find that to be a little bit infantilizing. Like, why can't we have the option to work on these things? And I would, you know, let's go back to cars. The fact that you can, you know, get the brakes changed at your local garage on your Honda Civic does not undermine Honda's market position. It actually makes the product more valuable. There's more of an ecosystem. There's more support. And it would be the same thing with Apple products.
So what do you think the FTC is going to do?
Well, this is interesting. So the FTC has kind of more broad powers than we think. A lot of folks think that FTC is solely on antitrust, but the way that they're looking at enforcing this is not via antitrust. They're looking at establishing a rule. And the FTC has kind of broad rulemaking authority. For example, one thing I didn't know until this executive order and I started researching it is that there is an eyeglass rule that the FTC has passed that says that the eye doctors have to give you your prescription for your glasses so that you can go and buy glasses somewhere else. That's not a law. That's a rule that the FTC passed. And I have personally benefited from that many times. So you can imagine them coming up with a rule that says, hey, if you're going to, you know, make information, fancy tools, parts available to your authorized repair centers, you need to also make those available to your customers.
How likely do you think that is? Are you hopeful?
We're very hopeful. We have Lena Khan, who's sort of an antitrust wunderkind, who is coming up. She's now the head of the Federal Trade Commission, and she's expressed interest in working on this. The FTC has scheduled their meeting next week. They're going to roll out and have a vote on a right to repair policy. Historically, FTC rules take a long time, but the FTC has actually been working on repair for a while now. They held a workshop two, maybe 3 years ago, where they brought stakeholders together, spent a couple years working on the report, and they released a report to Congress in May. There was a bipartisan report looking at the manufacturer arguments, the ones that you mentioned, and basically systematically eviscerating them and saying there is no evidence that manufacturer repair restrictions have anything to do with safety or security. It seems to solely be a monopolistic practice, and maybe we should do something about this. So the FTC is ready to go.
Kyle Weens, the CEO of iFixit, talking right to repair. Thanks, Kyle. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me. Yeah, thank you.
Good stuff, man. We'll see where this goes. That's all I'm saying.
600,000 cars.
I know.
I mean, it is just astonishing to me that companies can come along and say, you know, we have a commitment to being carbon neutral by such and such a time, and we're putting like solar on our data centers, but we're basically selling you phones on a subscription service every 2 years.
Right.
And you check the old ones.
And they're doing it just because they can, just because they decided, hey, we're going to do this. Stop.
And this is, I mean, I feel like that's what's so interesting in some ways about, like, right to repair is a perfect example of just what happens when there's not competition. And right. All of the ways that companies think of to reduce competition in this kind of, like, halo effect of businesses. Like, you think, oh, well, I can only choose between a Samsung, you know, effectively, right? Like, there's a duopoly. I can have Android or iOS, and my Android's probably going to be a Samsung.
Right.
But what you don't realize is, oh, there's also a universe of repair shops that don't exist or could exist that don't. Super interesting.
Choices.
If you're a giant nerd.
Only if. which, you know, may be some small portion of the people listening to this podcast. We are going to a break. Send us your comments, would you, on today's show. You can do it, of course, by sending us an email or a voice memo. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org is the address.
Or you can call us. I'm going to play this one straight because apparently I triggered a wave of smart speakers calling our phone number yesterday when I said, I didn't realize I have to say and her girl. But that happened.
That sound you hear is Bridget Bonner's head exploding.
Yeah, she's like, please stop. Anyway, you can call us and leave us a voice message. This is very exciting. Our brand new phone number is 508-827-6278. Also known as 508-82-SMART. Never gets old. We'll be right back.
Nice cackle. Oh, man.
You guys, it spells smart.
Oh,
it's
man.
So funny.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, time for the news fix. What are we doing? What is this? What have you brought? Long read?
There's kind of a long read. It's more of a cautionary tale about SPACs and electric vehicles and hubris and the difficulty of the aforementioned electric vehicles. There's an article in the New York Times today about the, and this is the headline, the debacle of Lordstown Motors, which for a brief shining nanosecond was a shiny, shiny object in the world of electric trucks. But it turns out, due to a lot of forces, one of which was greed, the other of which was hubris, the other of which was difficulty, and a fourth of which was just sheer, we don't know what we're doing-ness, it all fell apart. It all fell apart. And this has to do with the General Motors legacy factory in Lordstown, Ohio, and how it got taken over by this guy who wanted to build electric trucks, and then it went public through a SPAC. Anyway, really interesting read, really interesting behind-the-scenes just sort of TikTok about how this thing fell apart. And I dug it, and people should read it, both for how difficult it is to do electric vehicles, but also for the shenanigans that go along behind the scenes. I liked it.
It is. It's really good. And this is not the only one that's like this, right?
Sure.
There's also, what's the one, Nikola?
Yep.
I mean, I'll tell you, it hurts me in the heart to give Elon Musk credit, but the dude got an actual car company off the ground in the United States.
Exactly right. I think that's exactly right. He is weird and destructive and who knows what, 19 ways from Sundays, but holy cow, look at all those Teslas out there, you know?
I mean, and there's not scamming going on there, too.
Right. That's a whole different
of
story.
Of the kind that he's in court for, right. I believe, as we are speaking right this second.
Yep.
Nevertheless, like it is it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Then it seems to attract con men.
Yeah.
Which is just its own kind of fascinating thing. I have been steeped in the world of antitrust this week, partly because shameless plug. If you listen to Marketplace Tech, you'll hear we're doing 3 days.
Could I just, let me interject, and I apologize for interrupting. There I am at 4:44 in the morning expecting one Kimberly Adams to pop onto my radio with a Marketplace Tech. And who is it but the actual host of the program? What the hell?
I know. Well, I came back for a special 3-day stint because we interviewed EU Commissioner Margrethe Vestager. Better known as that lady who keeps giving tech companies all the trouble over in Europe. She's basically the regulator in charge of competition and digital policy, and is just with every passing minute a bigger and bigger deal in the world of antitrust, and has led the charge to kind of like reframe thinking about these companies as gatekeepers, which is what tomorrow's show is going to be about. But it's this sort of innovation in thinking about antitrust. Like, oh, the problem with these big companies is that the way they exercise their monopoly is that they control access to other companies, whether they're app developers or retailers. And that has provided this sort of whole new line of attack, even for U.S. regulators, which is kind of interesting. On that note, Google's been in this big snafu, which I think we've talked about.
Yeah,
Australia and France have been trying to get Facebook and Google and other big digital companies, but pretty much just Facebook and Google, to pay local publishers for news. And it's been super controversial because it was like pay for clicks, which is pretty contrary to how the web has ever worked. Google was supposed to, in 2020, it had been ordered to negotiate in good faith if it was going to display snippets of articles on Google News. So you search something on Google News and you see like a little summary of the article. They were supposed to negotiate with these news outlets to pay them for that, if not specifically for links. France has now alleged that Google just didn't. That Alphabet was like, no, thank you. Did not negotiate in good faith, if at all, according to regulators in France. And they have now fined Google $593 million.
Man.
It's the second biggest French antitrust penalty so far. Google, or Alphabet, of course, says, you know, that's not true. We're very disappointed. We acted in good faith, which of course they did.
Yeah.
But yeah, France lately especially has been not messing around. France is the one that came up with the idea of the digital tax. Like, you have to pay taxes here if you do business here, even if you don't have an office here. So, you know, look, $593 million, half a billion dollars, not a huge amount of money for Google. And yet, the drip, drip, drip of many digit, I can't do the math fast enough to know how many digits are in 593 million, but like a lot.
Yeah.
Nine digit fines. At some point, the nine digit fines do start to add up.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's like, you know, couch cushion change figuratively for that company, but enough of them and it matters.
Yep, definitely.
Yep.
That's it.
There we go.
That's all I got
done
for the news fix.
All right.
Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Might be the best mailbag sting on any podcast ever. I'm just saying. Last week we talked with Annabelle Gerwich about downward mobility. Nick in Seattle sent us his story.
In 2008, my mom lost her job, and like many others, could no longer afford the mortgage on her house. We were foreclosed upon and evicted 2 days before my high school graduation. My mother then spent the next year unhoused while I was off at college trying to piece together the past and determine my future. 6 years later, through a series of several unfortunate events combined with rising rental costs, my dad and sister lost their housing. Nowadays, fortunately, both of my parents have housing, and I work as a software engineer in Seattle, so I'm doing quite okay. But having seen just how quickly life can turn around, often through no fault of your own, well, it scares me.
I think that was the moral of Annabelle's story, right? Is that this, there but for the grace of God, right? One car accident, one missed something payment, and who knows what the heck happens. For sure.
And it's a cascade.
Yeah.
And no help is coming. Yeah. Yeah, that is absolutely brutal. I'm glad everybody's doing okay now.
Yeah.
But wow. Last week, we also asked you to weigh in on what you think America does well. Social safety net, obviously not making the list. We did, however, receive a lot of it. It was just a hard turn. I'm just trying to make
that
turn elegantly.
No, that's good. More power to you.
We received a lot of submissions. Mark in Irvine said jazz, barbecue, IPAs.
Yeah.
Also, that whole freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom to assembly, freedom to redress your government thing, but especially, says Mark, barbecue. Can't lie.
Can't lie.
Cynthia in Oregon said the U.S. Postal Service.
Oh, wow.
May it ever be so, but not untrue. And then we also got this voice memo from Tessa in Ohio.
As a recent college grad, I would answer that America does higher education well. While there are mounting problems concerning their affordability, American colleges and universities continue to rank among the best in the world and play an important role in fostering the entrepreneurship and opportunities Molly mentioned in her answer. I think the rest of the world would agree, since many of the most popular colleges in the U.S. have student bodies that are more than 10% international students. But if you disagree, please make me smart. Thanks.
No, I don't disagree at all. I totally agree with that. We do higher education really well. Challenges with, you know, whether you can get a job coming out and affordability for sure, but I think the general thrust is right. Totally true.
Yep, I think that's absolutely true. And it's such a shame that we are undervaluing the education that leads up to higher education so much.
Yep.
So maybe we could start doing that better also. That would be super.
Do it again, but
be
better.
Great.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. I'm acutely aware, by the way, that I have not yet answered that question because everything I come up with is just, it sounds trite and I don't want to be trite on this podcast. So I'm still working on my way through that one, just so everybody knows. Okay. So we're out of here with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, later found out you were wrong about?
Today's answer comes from Margarethe Vestager, the commissioner with the European Union I mentioned a minute ago, the one who oversees competition. I spoke with her, of course, recently on Marketplace Tech, and then I asked her our question.
I thought I knew that that getting older was something you would dislike. And I feel completely different. You know, the older I get, the more I like age. I really feel that I've been, you know, I was completely wrong when I was young.
Wow. Now I have to Google her.
There are going to be three interviews with her this week. And
she's younger than I am. Oh, my God. Sorry.
Really?
Sorry. Yes. Sorry.
Guys, like, oh, God. No, that's okay. That just means you have to rethink your feelings about your age.
Oh, man.
It was such I mean, it's so funny how they, when you ask someone this question, you never know which way they're going to go, especially because a lot of times, like, we've been hanging out talking about work for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And so either they're going to, you know, be on message and say something about like motivating their employees or whatever, or they're going to be an introspective Dane.
That's right. All right. I cut you off. Let's get the plug in there for tech. I cut you off. Sorry. With my
honest. Oh, it's okay. The three-part interview starts today, Tuesday, on Marketplace Tech. We're talking about taxation. The digital taxes are on hold for now, but the global minimum tax is coming. And they might get hit. Big tech could get hit with a double whammy, which is kind of exciting for them. Tomorrow is gatekeeping, and then Thursday will be disinformation.
Taxes.
Super
and
interesting
fines.
Lady.
It's all good for big tech. All right. Let's see. Your answer to the Make Me Smart question, no matter how old you are, what is something you thought you knew, later found out you were wrong about? You can reach us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, our phone number, which I'm going to have to scroll up in the rundown to get to you. And it goes like this. It's 508-827-6278, 508-82-SMART is how you can call us.
It would have been funny for the Simpsons fans to make it SMRT. I am so smart. SMRT. Just look it up. It's the Simpsons thing. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skills. Our intern is Grace Rubin, who did some extra lifting for us on the show. We
also
don't know what that is, but I'm assuming she's fit.
Also last week, by the way. Also last week when some people were on vacation,
when Marissa was out. Oh, yeah.
Today's program was in the capable hands of Leon Asqualache. Drew Jostedt's going to mix it down later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. This, I wonder if it's in their contract that they get that name every time. Senior producer is Bridget Bonner. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Boom. Timing. Right there. That's what that
Perfect.
Was. Boom.
Perfection.
If I had a mic, I would drop it.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.